Welcome to this new podcast series from Green Alliance, the charity and think tank that's all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. I'm Amy Mount, and today I'm bringing you the best bits from the first of three live debates exploring the controversial questions about the future of land, our food, and the environment. In this episode, is technology a force for good in environmentally sustainable food production? Or could it do more harm than good? And what are the wider social and ethical implications? Those are the big questions we put to an expert panel. We were lucky to be joined by the Professor of Robotics, Simon Blackmore, Helen Browning, who runs the Soil Association, the campaigner and social scientist Robin Grove White, and Alistair Cooper, an investor and organic farmer. Our host for the event was Christine Taken, groceries code adjudicator and farming businesswoman. Over to her.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Christine Taken. I have quite a few roles today, but one of them is that I'm the groceries code adjudicator. Simon Blackmore, I'll introduce first. We both know each other from our Harper Adam days. Then Alistair Cooper. Alistair is of ADM Capital, so he's an organic farmer, but also knows a lot more about how we access money, because technology is one thing, but how do we get the money to make it work? Helen Browning from the Soil Association, and Robin Grove White, who I'm hoping is going to bring more of a social science dimension to the debate, which I think is well worth thinking about. So, Simon, can I hand over to you to start, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Christy. Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Professor Simon Blackmore from Harper Adams University. I'm an agriculture engineer. I've been interested in precision farming for about 30 years now. I am an engineer, so I'm interested in the technology. I've been developing the concepts of robotic agriculture. We have a suite of viable technologies that can, I believe, revolutionize the way in which we grow crops. The sort of machines that I'm developing are small, smart machines, and it is going to be very disruptive. We will farm in a very different way in the future. But as we've been looking at these systems, I've obviously been comparing them with how we farm now, the machinery systems that we have now, and I've now come to the conclusion that the agricultural machinery system is not fit for purpose. It is wrong. It is totally wrong. It's all based on economies of scale, machines getting bigger all the time. That's one form of efficiency. I am promoting a different form of efficiency that I call intelligently targeted inputs. Now, that might sound fanciful, but I would say it's no more than what you do in your garden. So if you have a weed in your garden, you don't go and spray the whole field and hope to kill that one weed. You go and deal with that one weed. When you're growing your tomatoes, you don't go and out to the tomato and harvest every single tomato there and throw 50% away. This is what a lot of commodity farmers are doing at the moment. And what you do is that you go and see the right tomato and you pick that tomato and then you eat it. And that's what we're trying to do with the robots. And my role is to commercialize this, and I'm really, really, really excited about how close we are. And so I'm looking forward to a good discussion this evening. Thank you, Christine.
Can I ask you to talk about some of the disadvantages of the very large machines, having them on fields? They are, as you said, they are super efficient.
These big machines cause as many problems as they solve. So I now estimate 90% of the energy going into cultivation is there to repair the damage caused by the big machines in the first place.
The weight of them on the soil.
The weight of the machines. Every year we are damaging the soil, and every year we are repairing the soil, and every year we're damaging the soil. And come on, this is daft. So the sorts of machines we're now developing are ultralight machines that can go out at field capacity and not do any damage to the soil and still be able to do things that we want them to do.
Could you show us with your arms how big they are?
No, my arms aren't quite that big enough, okay. But that, table size, that's about the size of machines. So in fact, again, okay, I'm radical, I'm saying lots of crazy things, but I think we've now got to ban the tractor and ban the 36-metre boom sprayer, and we'll start with those two, and then we'll see what else we can get rid of later on.
Thank you. Simon has got loads of ideas. You've scratched the surface of some of the stuff that he can talk about. So I'll drag some more out of him later on. Alistair.
Yep. My name's Alistair Cooper. And as I said earlier, I've got two hats. One, for 16 years, I've been an organic farmer. I own and run a mixed traditional organic farm down in Dorset. And the other hat, I'm an investor. I'm a partner in a private equity company focused on the food and agri-tech space. There's a perfect storm obviously hitting the world in terms of food production. Resources are now limiting, yields have plateaued, yet at the same time, demand for food is obviously increasing at an accelerating rate. You know, a key reason for that is the agrarian to urban migration. Within that, the growth of middle class, and generally within that, a change in diet. And you know, as GDP increases, middle class increases, diets change. And they change towards a higher calorific, higher protein, and more demanding diet for the world to produce. And that's key at this time when basically you know, plateau and production is sort of maxed as it is. So I'm coming from the viewpoint that unless we start embracing this plethora of extraordinarily new, exciting, and disruptive technologies, you know, we're just not going to meet this increase in demand. You know, every morning when we get up, there's 230,000 more mouths in the world to feed than there was the prior morning. In the next 40 years, we need to produce probably more food than we've ever produced before in the history of mankind. And I'm somebody that sort of moved very quickly in the last 6 or 7 years from being a sort of peak everything believer and thinking it was all doom and gloom to actually now seeing this extraordinary, and Simon was talking about this extraordinary breadth of new technologies coming in to the food agri space. Some of you might know in the last year, for example, in the venture capital world, which is early stage small companies, the food agri space was the fastest growing area of investment, of capital raising. And I think that's indicative of the scale of opportunities starting to emerge. My fund has been around for a year now. We've made a number of exciting investments, but I'll give you an idea of one that we invested in about a year ago. It's a company called AeroFarms. It's situated in Newark, New Jersey, just 9 miles outside Manhattan, in a converted steel mill, 70,000 square foot. They grow leafy green salad leaves aeroponically under LED lighting. So in this environment, they're growing salad leaves 14 levels high under LED lighting. There's zero seasonality. There's complete predictability. The life cycle of the plant's taken down to just 16 days. So you're getting 26 crops a year, 14 levels high, around 250 times the equivalent production to field grown. And you're using 95% less water, 85% less nutrients, no sprays. And you're disrupting the supply chain. You're moving the point of production next to the point of consumption. So harvest is automatic, packaging is automatic, and delivery to the retailers in a matter of hours. So wastage is taken down to less than 3%. You know, compared today, if you live in New York, everything comes from California, a lot of water, sprays. It's been washed in chlorine. It's 7 to 12 days to arrive at the retailer, and there's 15 to 20% wastage in that supply chain. So to me, it's a great example of a you know, disruption of the resource use, but disruption of the supply chain. And it's the type of technology we need to start embracing you know, to supply this increase in demand.
What does your lettuce grown indoors under LED lights actually taste like, and how nutritious is it?
Well, against my expectation, the taste is phenomenal. I mean, I, as an organic farmer, I was expecting a flabby, you know, tasteless product, but actually the taste is... it's quite extraordinary, the incredible texture and smell and taste. And I mean, what is scary to a degree, but maybe exciting, is the fact, I mean, during that 16-day crop life cycle, AeroFarms takes 130,000 data points. So it's measuring every nutrient, micronutrient, CO2, O2, pH, humidity, airflow. It's has cameras on the plants with visual recognition technology, monitoring the growth stage and health of the plant. And it controls the LED lighting by the color, burst, and intensity. And what you can do is not only optimize for the plant the conditions it wants for each growth stage of the plant, but you can also stress the plant for the outcome you want. So if you want your rocket more spicy, you can make your rocket more spicy. If you want your rocket with more vitamin C, you can put more vitamin C in your rocket. So the long and short answer is actually it does taste surprisingly good, and actually nutrient benefit can be substantially higher.
And you're eating it much, much faster.
You're eating so much, much faster with no chlorine wash, which is a big problem we all have with our salad leaves.
Yeah. Are these products in the market now?
Yes, they are, yeah. This company, AeroFarms, markets through to Whole Foods, ShopRite, yeah. Fresh Direct, the biggest internet delivery on the east coast of the States, and under a brand called Dream Greens, and the response has been fabulous.
Closer to home, we are actually growing salads in the disused tube tunnels in London.
Yeah.
Under LED lights, which is quite exciting. There's a bit of an American theme to what you've been saying. Are we behind the curve here?
I think we're behind the curve in terms of risk capital. A lot of these new technologies obviously come with risk. Risk needs risk takers, and it needs people with available capital that are going to take that risk. A key thing I think we have to think about is how we incentivize risk takers and how we incentivize capital.
Thank you. Move on to Helen then.
Thank you. I'm Helen Browning. I'm chief exec of the Soil Association, a trustee of the Food Ethics Council, and a farmer in Wiltshire. So I'm a farmer, and we make products and we run a pub and we do all sorts of crazy things that you should never do. I guess, addressing the sort of theme of this, is technology a force for good? I mean, technology is always potentially a force for good or a force for evil. It is about your values and motivations, what you're trying to do with the technology. While I am equally excited by a lot of the things that Simon and Alistair have been talking about, I think we always have to look at the risks and benefits of getting where we're trying to go and what paths you can choose to take. So I'm going to just chime a cautionary moment. At the same time, I'm really pleased that a lot of what we're talking about here so far this evening is around the engineering world, where I think it's just been very overlooked. We've spent a lot of time over the last few decades concentrating on chemistry and then on sort of biology and genetics. And I think to be looking at engineering and data solutions is really refreshing. They're not very high tech compared to what we've just heard about, but the ability now for us to be able to log data. I have an agroforestry project. I'm logging the data from every tree, and the technology to be able to do that is in itself quite revolutionary. To handle that data from 9,000 trees, things like rumen boluses, again, quite simple things that allow us to see what
temperature. You might need to tell everybody what that is.
A rumen bolus, a temperature probe, effectively, which is in the cows.
They swallow it.
And it stays with them, and it can tell you when their temperature changes. So you can detect illness, or you can detect when they're likely to calve very precisely because of those rumen changes or the changes in rumination themselves. So there's a lot of those kind of ideas, as well as robotic milking parlours, which I've seen revolutionise the lives of small family farms in Northern Ireland and other places because they're no longer tied to that twice daily milking routine. So I think there's a lot to go in here, but we must remember that innovation can be very low tech too. I've been very instrumental in helping develop something called the Innovative Farmers Network within the Soil Association, which is actually funding farmers to be running their own trials. Those approaches in terms of trying to make sure that we're putting equivalent amounts of effort into using the resources that farmers have on their farms and enabling them to lead the way in terms of what research they need is also part of this mix. It's a balancer to this mix. The final point I want to make on a more cautionary note, particularly when we're looking at some of these huge investments coming into urban tech farming systems, which I can see have huge potential to take the pressure off our land and allow us to use our land more wisely, I want to make sure that power is distributed, that food is in many hands, not just in a few.
Thank you. Robin, different flavour, I think.
Probably a different flavour, yes, but very interesting. I live in Anglesey, in a very hands-off way, certainly not like Helen, run a very small family estate. I was formerly director of the CPRE, I was chairman of Greenpeace, and I was director of a research centre at Lancaster University. So my focus, and maybe I'm just inserting this so that it's part of our discussion, is what are the sort of vulnerabilities that new technologies may have socially in this domain? I think we should distinguish the vulnerabilities that are specifiable in advance, so risk assessments with, if you like, scientifically defined parameters. You know, what are the impacts on insect diversity of the employment of robotics for arable production, for example? You know, these sort of accessible, definable issues. But there's a second class of potential vulnerabilities which are inherently unspecifiable social reactions. As we've seen in many controversies about technologies like nuclear power or genetically modified crops, all sorts of, if you like, social tensions can condense onto particular technologies in unexpected ways. I mean, in the case of GM crops, in the rows between sort of 1998-2003, there were some very good risk assessments. There was quite a lot of preparation for GMs. There were very good risk assessment processes sanctioned at EU level, implemented in the UK for particular GM constructs. And these were the, as it were, the precautionary measures that governments were taking. Those were actually side issues compared with the wider social political concerns that condensed onto the technology. Who owned it? Who was benefiting? Where was this coming from? Why was it necessary? And that was what sunk it, frankly, in Europe for a space. Therefore, I'm not saying at all that in any particular case this is going to be controversial, but unexpected social forces have to be considered part of the equation. And bear in mind also that in post-Brexit, there are going to be all sorts of tensions about trade arrangements and so on, vis-a-vis food and agriculture. Maybe this will be part of the mix too.
Thank you. Lots of different views. I'm really pleased people are putting the questions on, and it's great because if you can all vote on them. Moving on to that theme, our very first question is relying on technology to meet the growing demand a get-out clause for us changing our behaviour and diet to become more sustainable? Now, I particularly, I was that you were saying as we get more middle class, everybody in the world wants to eat more meat, which of course is one of the most extravagant ways of
absolutely.
Eating.
Absolutely. And the only way to make real change, and to address Helen and Simon's points, is to price the externalities of food production. Mm-hmm. And sadly, human nature is about making money. I mean, that's what drives most people, most farmers. They need to have an income for themselves and their family. And most consumers will buy on value more than any other reason. So if food production is not being priced in a way that truly reflects its cost to the world and to the environment, yeah, then you're never going to get the right outcome.
I wanted to talk about, the question, it was Samuel Smith posed it. Does the panel see potential issues around data ownership, transparency and trust from new tech? And how should we address this? And, you know, going right the way back to GM, there was the core, you know, the sort of, the, you know, the killer genes, you know, so that you couldn't harvest the crop and grow it again. You always had to go back to the source. You're talking about artificial intelligence. I mean, I heard of the guy that had bought a new combine and it wouldn't work. And he was absolutely furious and rang up the dealership and said it wouldn't work. And they were trying to work out what was happening. It turned out that he hadn't paid one installment and it had been turned off remotely from the manufacturers. You know, that is the degree of intelligence that exists. But can you give me some thoughts about the artificial intelligence and how that can be used and manipulated? And should we be worried about it?
There's a big discussion coming up now. I can see what's prompting the question is about big data and who owns it, yes, and who controls, yes, it and so on. With the advent of more and more of these machines, more and more of the sensors, there is an interesting part that's sort of coming out from all of this, and that is that we may well be at the stage where the data about the product is worth more than the fundamental price of the product itself. Can we trust it? Who owns it? So we've got issues at the moment, which I think is making many farmers feel uneasy, where other companies are gathering this data about farms and about the productivity, and it doesn't then belong to the farmer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So fundamentally, we are having a problem here, but they are seeing this as being marketable and having value, but are not sharing that value with the person who we would normally think actually should own that data. There are various companies now purchasing farm data without the farmers actually knowing that data is being sold on.
And what sort of things is it being used for? Is there really a commercial interest in it?
Well,
who's buying the data once it's been analysed?
I mean, there is, again, it's a double-edged sword. There is honest legitimacy in this in terms of many farmers would be very interested in benchmarking. Mm. How am I doing compared to somebody else with similar sort of situation? So, but the point of that is, with the benchmark, is that it's been anonymized.
Yeah.
So that you can then say, on average, or in my area, or in this crop, this is then of value to know whether you're doing well or not. But we're not at the end of this process.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Angela Francis, Green Alliance. We've talked a lot about technology and how that can support improved use of inputs. I wonder if there are technological examples of, this will be the wrong example, of radio tagging livestock or crop products so that governments or customers can differentiate how they've been produced that has a wider effect on the wider environment. So this crop was produced in somewhere that has high biodiversity standards, or this crop was produced somewhere where it's had there's good soil quality, so that governments could, in some future world, preference food that was coming from somewhere that had higher natural capital contributions. Is that already happening? Could it happen?
There are some technologies that we can use. I'm working with a company at the moment looking into this. A consumer would be able to go to a supermarket with a smartphone and be able to use that smartphone to relate back to find out everything that is then, not everything, but all the pertinent parts to what has happened to the farm. We can do that at the moment back to the farm gate, but the problem has always been before the farm gate. So this is where the robots and the individual plant care system can kick in to be able to continue that chain all the way through. So we are working on that. I'm not going to explain the technologies that we're considering at the moment because that's a bit sensitive, but we are certainly aiming or hoping to be able to do that.
Thank you. Gentleman there.
I'm David Sanders from FTI Consulting. When you look at some of the emerging markets, like, say, India, 40 to 50% of the food is wasted from the farm to the consumer, unlike in developed markets where we waste it by buying too much and then throwing it away. I wonder if there's some technologies that enable the emerging markets like India to leapfrog what we've done here and design almost a system from scratch suited to their needs with their huge growth, their lack of any cold chain, making the farmers very poor and all the food waste.
Alistair, do you got some?
Well, firstly, I'd say that, I mean, the technology that I've been talking to are applicable in the emerging and developing countries. The vertical farming, the company I'm looking at, we're invested in that, has signed a deal to roll 50 out across China, a whole load across the Middle East. What I would say is, I mean, there are some technologies. An area of big focus at the moment is the whole area of biostimulants, biofertilizers, and biopesticides. And we're obviously starting to understand an enormous amount more about beneficial microbes, bacteria, fungi, and how they interact with plants, with the soil, increasing metabolism rates, increasing nitrogen uptake naturally, and allowing us to reduce significantly inputs and increase yields and increase quality to a degree. And there's some really exciting developments in that. And funny enough, the company I'm looking at most in that space, its fastest growing area and biggest area of uptake is India. And for a reason which I'm not aware of myself, that it is the by far and away the country with the strongest uptake of natural biostimulants, biofertilizers, and biopesticides.
Is that small? I'm just trying to link it to a question.
And it's all going to
small farmers.
Yes, it is going to small farmers.
And,
yeah.
And it's not being sort of controlled by big companies.
No, it's not. No, it's being made available. And they're clearly starting to see the benefits in terms of reduced sprays and pesticides and things like that.
They can sort of leapfrog everything we've done with when we sort of bought these huge great big tractors and everything else, and they'll just cut that out and go straight to the next generation. Yeah. Can I stop you there and let... I'm going to ask Robin to comment on this whole idea of bringing technology onto small farms to increase production, but is it actually displacing people and livelihoods? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, from my experience of small farms, you know, in a remote part of the country in Wales, it seems extremely improbable. I mean, the problems of access to capital, the cultural lag...
Well, I was going to come in on this one. I think we're really schizophrenic about, or the government's very schizophrenic about jobs and how we're going to live in the future and whether we want these kind of jobs or we don't want these kind of jobs. And on one hand, we're kind of getting job creation schemes. On the other, we're saying, well, actually, Gove is very clear. We're not going to have the labour to do it. Go to robotics. That's going to be the solution. I'm really interested, though, in how do we get more people living and working in the countryside? And one of the biggest barriers to that actually is housing. And the access to land. And so I think that alongside, I think you're right, I think that this robotics could help with some of that in terms of managing those smaller scale holdings well. But we also need to crack some other social issues and think quite hard about how do we want to live and what sort of, how do we allow more people who do want to get involved in growing food, and I think they can produce a lot of nutrients per acre as well. How do we do that, and what's the social context we need to be developing to do that?
One of the social policies, I've got some friends developing robots in Japan. One of the problem that they saw in Japan was the aging rural population, and the young people were moving from the rural to the... This is happening everywhere. So they actually invested in a major agricultural robot program to actually, the high technology is attractive to many people, particularly many young people.
You're still some people with livestock, though. Animals will always need some people around.
I'm going to take my last question for the gentleman at the back there. I hope it's a good one.
No pressure.
No
pressure.
My name
is Richard Hebbich from the National Trust. To see this kind of technological uptake in the UK, do you need to revolutionise who is farming in the UK, or do you think it because of Brexit, actually farmers will embrace this technology?
Right, I think that's a really good question. Thank you. Helen, will you challenge the gentleman's assumption that farmers are slow adopters?
Well, I think you've got a really wide population of farmers. You've got some, like, you have every other population. You've got some early adopters, you've got some real pioneers, you've got people who are much more conservative. And so I think as in any market, you'll see, and you've probably got actually, you know, you have got some people who are quite isolated in the farming community. So I think you will see this happening over a period of time. And in some places, it's more appropriate than others anyway. You know, it's not saying that everybody's going to have to rush off down this road. If you're farming in the uplands and you're running sheep systems or beef and whatever, then, you know, there may be some elements that are going to be really helpful, but they may not be quite so necessary. I think farmer-to-farmer learning is the key thing, though. I think farmers respect other farmers. They love to see what other farmers are doing.
It's looking over the hedge.
So the way, and the AgriEpi, whatever they call it, these, you know, all this funding that's going into trying to get technology taken up, I think is trying quite hard to get farmers. We're part of it to be testing some stuff that other people can look at, so that you get people developing confidence this might work for them too. You need to actually take some of the risk out of it for those early adopters so that other people can see it working, can see the benefits, and will hear it from the farmer rather than from a sales rep. But I can see that actually companies, including some of the chemical companies, will be service providers in this area. So just as you sort of maybe rent your carpets now, or you bring in a service to do certain functions for you, that you'll be able to bring in your team of robots or your technologies as a service. You don't necessarily have to own it, invest in it yourself. You might be able to pay as you go on some of this stuff, and that will make it a bit more accessible too. And I think finally, in terms of some of Alistair's end of it, it would be really interesting to me to think about how, at what point does this scale down? because he's doing really big, big, big stuff. I'm really interested in making that more available and accessible at a small scale, just a bit like sort of AD. You know, that all was started off a massive scale, huge problems around scale sometimes. Sometimes the things that are good at a small scale are less good at a big scale, perhaps the opposite. But I would love to see some of these kind of circular systems being scaled down to make them more appropriate for more people, because my big worry is still about this concentration of capital and influence and power in the food system being in one place as it is now, rather than being better distributed.
Right, Robin, yeah. You know, inspire us how we're going to educate
farmers.
Well,
I don't know. I agree with Helen. I think that there's a big problem about who will own these technologies and who will get benefit from them. The unknowability of how things are going to shake out after Brexit. You know, who's going to go out of business and who's going to be operating this new, less subsidised framework? A very big question.
So I wanted to thank all my panel and ask you to thank them in a minute, but I think I also ought to thank Green Alliance for having the courage to put something like this together. It's your first of three debates, I think it's, you know, I think you put a good panel together, and it was an easy one to chair, so thank you for being a good audience. And if you could just thank my panel members.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back again soon with another debate about the future of land, the environment, and food. Make sure you subscribe in your favourite podcast app to get the next episode automatically. In the meantime, send us your thoughts on what you've just heard. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook at Green Alliance UK. I'm Amy Mount. See you next time.